date. It is Wednesday, March the 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody listening. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I want to make sure that I give shout outs to the patrons of the show, patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast, if you're interested in supporting the show monetarily. I'm getting a little bit of like kind of weird staticky feedback in my headphones. Hopefully it won't come across when this actually gets published, but the actual interview doesn't have any of that. So I've checked all my cables. I've rebooted. I've rebooted the computer. I've rebooted the Zoom H4 recorder. So we'll just roll with it. So let me give a shout out to Nathan and Valerie, John, Brooke, Carrie, Jason, David, Colette, Matthew, Mindy, Irina, Kelly, Tony, Francisco, Ashley, Michael, Victoria, Chad, Anthony, Jen, and Nate, Christina, Ross, Caroline, Julie, Casey, Brian, Arnie, Barb, and Kim. 30 patrons. So awesome. It's so good to see. And again, thank you to Raph de Groot for producing that brand new podcast theme song. Hopefully everybody likes that. Interview today. So this is with Jacqueline Nates. And you can learn more about her. She's a psychotherapist by going to Jacqueline. That's J-A-C-Q-U-E-L-I-N-E. Nates, N-A-T-E-S, M-F as in Frank, T.com. To learn a little bit more about working with her and some of her methodology and the services that she provides, mind-body coaching, TMS therapy, different things like that. Really cool story. We recorded this a few weeks ago, and I'm excited for everybody to kind of learn about it. On her website, she talks about working with people that have everything from borderline personality disorder to work-related stress. So quite the bit of the gamut here. She had her own struggles with chronic pain. We talk about being an athlete, that kind of stuff too. So without further ado, here is Jacqueline Nates. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and I am here with another West Coaster. Jacqueline Nates is on the line with me. Jacqueline, can you hear me?
Sure can.
How's it going today?
It's going great. I am so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, the thing that really struck me about Jacqueline is that I didn't know who she was a month ago, but I got an introduction to her from a past guest, actually Julie Markowitz, who's been on the show two or three times now. What really struck me was your enthusiasm about the topic. So I'm excited to kind of dive in a little bit. And you have that unique perspective that I really always value. And that's somebody that has been through it, but now somebody who's actually contributing to, it's not the right terminology, but you know what I mean. Somebody who's a therapist that's actually going to be helping people in the field.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So let's get started with my story.
Yeah.
I was 26 years old. I bent down, I stood up the wrong way, as I thought, and that was it. I was double down in pain, flooded with the most intense, radiating knife I felt was stabbing me in my lower back. I could not move. I was laid on the ground. I had so much fear. My husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, brought me over to the couch and I just couldn't move. From there, I was calling different doctors. Then that led to me getting imaging done, x-rays done, you know, MRIs, and the MRI revealed that I had a herniated disc. And I said, oh my gosh, what is a herniated disc? And again, so much fear. And so that led me down the path of, you know, the traditional getting physical therapy, to getting acupuncture, to getting steroid injections, medications thrown my way. Nothing was working. And during this time, I was working toward my hours to become a licensed therapist. And I will never forget, I was sitting in sessions as an intern with ice packs in my sessions trying to get through. And I had such a passion to become a therapist because I have loved from the time I was a little girl listening to people's stories. And there was no way that this back thing was going to stop me. But it sure did, because it was debilitating. So I had to take a pause and take some time off. And I will never forget, I had a friend or someone had recommended Dr. John Sarno's book, Healing Back Pain. And I read every page and it was me to a T. Perfectionistic, people pleaser, a goodist, not wanting to burden others, avoiding confrontation at all costs. But I was in such tremendous fear. And all the information that I felt I really could absorb at the time was what doctors were telling me, which was you have this structural abnormality in your spine. And if it doesn't improve or physical therapy or whatever you're trying to do isn't helping within the course of the next year, then we recommend surgery. So I just had that in the forefront of my mind, even reading through every page of Dr. Sarno's book. I just could not absorb it. I couldn't digest it.
To get some clarification, so you said when you're 26, just so people know, and this is a question for the interview, so I'm not being rude. How old are you now, or how long ago was this?
I am 38 years old.
Okay.
Not rude at all.
Well, you never know. You never know.
No. No.
Okay, so despite reading Sarno and kind of knowing what it was about, I'm curious that at that point in time, because you were, you know, in the midst of training in psychotherapy, which is a lot to me. It's Sarno's book to me is more of like a psychotherapy book as opposed to like a Western medicine mm-hmm. book or whatever you would mm-hmm. want to classify it as. Was there anything in your training up to that point in school that talked mm-hmm. about this kind of stuff, whether it be, you know, let's just call it psychosomatic pain for simplicity?
Absolutely. I was trained psychodynamically.
Okay.
Which means that we carry patterns with us throughout our lives until we work through them. So things that are either in our unconscious, you know, or patterns from very early childhood that we have not worked through continue to emerge, reemerge in adult relationships if we haven't worked through things. So it's funny that you say that, because even though I'm a therapist and I was practicing toward my licensure at the time, I was in so much fear, and it shows how much fear plays into the role of the psyche, that it didn't matter how much I understood from a psychological perspective, I just couldn't digest it for myself, because I grew up in Western medicine. The doctors can fix me. The doctors can cure me. They know best. And I was in so much fear. So I couldn't take it in.
What I'm just kind of generally curious. I've never actually asked anybody this before, but it just came to mind is mm-hmm. up to that point, because I don't know what your background is, whether you were an athlete or whether you did sports as a kid or whatever, up to that point, yeah. What was the I guess, most dramatic or maybe worst injury that you had ever had that was fixed by Western medicine?
You know, it's
funny or that got better in the non-Sarno journal, you know, whatever we're going to get into later. But just like, you know, could be like as an example, I dislocated my shoulder, tore my rotator cuff, broke my arm, all this kind of stuff, sort of in one spectacular training moment, training for weightlifting. I had a surgery, the shoulder got better. So do you have any examples that are, here's an injury that I sustained, Western medicine worked? Because that kind of thing really ingrains that Western model.
Mm-hmm. It was pretty much that I tore my muscles when I was playing soccer mm-hmm. growing up, and the best thing was rest. Yeah. I had never broken an arm. I had sprained an ankle playing sports, and it was rest, you know. So I was an athlete my whole life. I had never had a broken bone or anything like that to convict me, you know, give me this sort of conviction of like, yes, that it has to be this way.
Yeah.
For me, I think truly it was just fear, and that is what led me in the path of continuing through with Western medicine at that time.
Gotcha.
So long story short there, I ended up seeing a well-known orthopedic surgeon. I had a microdiscectomy, which was on my L5-S1, where they shave off the portion of your disc that's bulging into your nerve, as I was told was causing me the tremendous pain. I was 28 years old at the time. It was 6 months before my wedding. As you can imagine, a lot of just stress and anxiety there, and prepping for everything, and the perfectionist in me wanting everything to go smoothly. And I was pretty good for a few years. And I thought that my spine surgeon had cured me. But a few years later, I would get flare-ups here and there. And exercise was my passion. And it was a form of release for me in life, always. So I never did the sauna work. I did the surgery route, as I just mentioned. And from there, I had my first son. And my son, I was 31 at the time, and I was doing well. I had also landed which was my dream job at UCLA, where I was a psychotherapist to university students from all over the world. And it was fascinating. And I specialized in mentalization-based treatment to help people work through their distressing emotions and how to regulate oneself, which was also based in attachment work.
Yeah.
So I was there doing my work at UCLA. And I remember telling myself, I'm good now. I can't have that back thing happen to me again. I always remember that in the back of my mind, like this fear. I won't have that back thing happen to me again. And then I would get flare-ups here and there. And when I say flare-ups, I mean there would be a couple day stretch where I just felt really tremendous spasm. And I would be like, oh shit, here I go again. And so much fear and so clenched with fear.
And did you,
but then it would go away.
Did you associate those sensations with anything you physically did, whether it was like, you know, you had a really strenuous this or you fell off a skateboard? I'm just making examples. But was there anything where you were like, it would sort of justify in your mind that this happened because of that, or I'm feeling this because of that, in a non-psychological way?
It could be, oh my gosh, I got off the couch the wrong way.
Okay.
I'm not
diminishing, but something stupid, really.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I remember that a really bad flare up happened. I was 6 weeks pregnant with my daughter, and we took my son to Disneyland for his third birthday. And I was walking around all of Disneyland Park, and I was like, oh my gosh, the next day I was hunched over and I couldn't move. I said, oh my gosh, I overdid it again by walking, right? Walking on pavement. Yeah. Oh, I shouldn't have walked on pavement. So then it went away again, though, and I was okay. Then after I had my daughter, I was good. I was feeling good. But the perfectionist in me said, okay, you've had your daughter. You are not going to be that mom that loses herself. You're going to lose that baby weight, and you're going to lose it fast, which also, I have to say, plays into a history of an eating disorder that I struggled with in my 20s. That perfectionistic, that sense of fake safety, that false sense of control to keep it all together.
Go, go, go,
and looking all that back, stuff. Yeah, go, go, go. And I basically was living in autopilot my whole life from a lot of big trauma that I had gone through. When I was, when my daughter was 9 months pregnant, I went to a really intense Pilates class. And I love Pilates, by the way. It's my absolute favorite type of exercise on the reformer machine. And this class was really intense. It was called the Legree method, where the spring loads on the reformer are super heavy duty. And it was just like anything I could do to just feel like I had it together. I was going to get my body in shape, and I was just going to look amazing and feel really good about myself, because I couldn't be fat. I couldn't be that mom that lost herself. Like, that was the message I constantly told myself. Then I will never forget, I attended this class, and several hours later, I was playing football with my son, just like throwing a soft little Nerf football back and forth. And I said, oh shit, I'm feeling this spasm sensation in my spine. So it's interesting, because it was different from the first time where I bent down and I stood up what I thought was the wrong way, where I was flooded with pain. But I just started to feel it much, much later on. And it was this spasm sensation. So I immediately went into fear. My husband and I were like, oh my gosh, you know, okay, why don't we just like call, you know, your spine surgeon, see what he recommends, which took me down this whole rabbit, you know, this rabbit hole of so much fear. And he said, okay, what do we need to do here? You know, you should get some, let's just take a look. Let's get an MRI again. So I had another MRI. It said that I had re-herniated my disc that I had surgery on.
Wow.
I said, oh my goodness, what does this mean? Does this mean that I'll need another microdiscectomy? What does this mean? And he said, no, you will need an artificial disc replacement.
How many years between the surgery and this moment was it?
8 years.
Okay.
So that gave me, as you can imagine, so much fear again. And I had put all my faith and all my power into him. And so then we got recommendations from a few other spine surgeons, and they all recommended the same thing. They said at this point that I had degenerative disc disease and that I needed an artificial disc replacement. One spine surgeon thought that I needed a double disc replacement on my L4, L5, and my L5S1. So just more and more panic. But it's really interesting because, again, you see how much fear goes into your actions in life and what you choose to do and how much I was controlled by fear. One doctor, and it really stuck with me, he said, if you don't act with soon, you will need a fusion. And I said, a fusion? Oh my goodness. And then there was so much research about artificial disc replacement and having more mobility than a fusion could give you. So that if you don't get this within the next 5 years, you will absolutely need a fusion. So again, you can just imagine how much fear. And it's really interesting because I went through the whole realm of physical therapy again, which did nothing, you know, and just, I felt like exacerbated my symptoms as I, you know, I was on medication for nerve, you know, to help with my nerves. And that's where there was a symptom imperative piece where my spasms shifted into awful sciatica.
Yeah.
So I had a bilateral burning sensation down both of my legs. And it was awful. I would sit in sessions at UCLA with just feeling just this horrible pain. And at that time, I went on a artificial disc replacement Facebook group.
Yeah, there it is.
which was the worst thing for me to do.
Yeah.
Because there I am getting all of these stories of people all over the world commiserating together on how horrific their back conditions are and that they're going to Germany for these artificial disc replacements. They're going all over the world, you know, and this is the best kind of artificial disc to get. Just again, so much fear, right? But that this was my best course at the time because this was the only information I really knew.
What, maybe like a sidestep just for a second, because it gets brought up actually a ton on in some of like the TMS forums that I'm either active in or moderate or whatever. The notion of, and it's weird because I'm sort of speaking to the TMS Facebook group about other Facebook groups, but you know, I was in I had this weird kind of like, it starts with a THY and it ends with duct. And it's like, basically it's like a lump in your neck. And I had joined like a Facebook mm-hmm. group about that. And I joined a Facebook group about a variety of other things. And it is this like sort of mass commiserating, just the therapist in you. Cause I don't know if I'm going to remember to ask this later. The therapist in you, what's your take on, I guess groups like that just in general, you know, sort of always kind of being bombarded with story after story after story and person commiserating and all that. Like, what's just kind of your scorching hot take just as a therapist in general?
If something is coming from a place of support, let's say in terms of grief and loss, right? That it feels different to me. But if it's something that, as I've gone through this work in my own personal journey, is a support group focusing on physical conditions of the body, everyone is commiserating around how awful they feel and that they're trying this method or this method. Or I even think of women with pelvic pain conditions of, I've tried this diet or eliminating this diet or GI issues, that it really, I have to say, depends on the kind of group you are entering. Because for something physical, I found for myself, whether therapist or just human to human, right, that it created so much fear.
Yeah.
So much fear. And that I had to do this. This is what I was supposed to do. And that this was the next right action for me to take. But that these people understood, right? So there's a sense of understanding. But there's also such a tremendous sense of connecting to each other's misery, where there feels like there's no way out.
Because then it's
one way.
It's not only like you internalizing your own issues, but now you're taking on everybody else's issues too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So I was on that artificial disc replacement group until I want to say 6 weeks after I ended up having the surgery. So I ended up going through and having the artificial disc replacement surgery, June 2019.
Yeah.
When I had the surgery, I can't even describe to you how much anxiety and fear I had the night before, because I also want to tell you that the sciatica shifted from a burning sensation to awful numbness, where I couldn't feel my legs when I would sit. So again, looking back, in terms of a symptom imperative or the sensations in your body and how they can shift, it went from horrible spasms to awful burning sensation down both of my legs, having steroid injections with absolute shit, and then into complete numbness down both my legs. So again, I told myself with the information at the time that I knew and that I was taking in, the only information that I felt I could take in at the time was Western medicine. And I have nothing against Western medicine, but these doctors are trained to focus on symptoms, right? And so I was doing what I thought was the best thing for me at the time. The recovery from the surgery was the most horrific experience of my life. I felt like my legs were being electrocuted for 6 months. And this is how I get into my TMS journey. I was in such complete despair that I had made myself worse. What have I done? My beautiful baby girl, who was 15 months old at the time, and my son was 4. What have I done? You know, oh my goodness, I should have just sucked it up and just gotten a fusion. But I kept having this message in my mind. I remember people would tell me like, no, you're doing the right thing. You know, little people, little problems, big people, big problems. And that, okay. And it was the perfectionist in me. If I am doing this at a set point, my son was graduating from preschool and I was going to do this in a summertime before he went into elementary school, and my daughter was young enough where she wouldn't remember, right? Like, I played all these narratives in my mind.
Yeah.
I was in such despair. I thought that I was going to be on medical leave from UCLA for 3 months. Of course, it turned into 6 months because the recovery was just insane. And I started to go into a spiritual path, trying to grasp anything I could to connect me to something, because I felt so alone. I connected to starting to look up Gabrielle Bernstein, to Joe Dispenza, to Louise Hay, there's a Heal documentary. Yeah. And I saw a woman from the Heal documentary, this sort of spiritual seeker. I saw women that were spiritual, sort of embodied seekers, sort of like blessing my soul. I mean, I saw it all. And out of sheer desperation, I Googled chronic pain and I found Nicole's work. And doing Nicole Sack's work and listening to various podcasts, Curable app, doing Nicole's course, retreats, I said, holy shit, this is what I've had all along is TMS. And I had to go through so much personal work of forgiving myself for the surgeries, because I had a lot of despair and anger toward myself that I had gone through this path in order to get here, and really forgiving myself. But I've learned that this is the beauty in this work, was I had to go through this path to get to where I am.
I'm curious, because you sort of, you know, you're going through this, which I just text Nicole to tell her, hey, there's a therapist I'm interviewing and she's raving about you. She'll love to hear that. But as you're going through and you're doing this, are you starting to feel better then?
I've healed myself.
Okay. Awesome.
And I still get things. And so again, another symptom imperative, which is really, you know, funny. I laugh about it because I know it's a symptom imperative. About a month after I had my artificial disc replacement surgery, which was June 2019, I developed coccidinia. And I don't know if you know what coccidinia is. Have you heard of it? Mm-mm. It is awful. It is where...
Is it that tiny little bone at the bottom of the spine? Is it?
It sure is.
Okay.
It sure is. So, of course, before I had found this work, I went through the x-rays, right? And it showed that I had a hairline fracture in my coccyx bone. I said, well, how does this happen? And yeah. I asked my spine surgeon, could my surgery have caused a hairline fracture in my coccyx bone? And he said, well, no, it's so far below, that would make zero sense. So I have gotten so much better, but the coccyx bone pain has continued on, you know, for way longer than what a hairline fracture would take to heal.
Right.
Right. So I still like have it, and I'm still like doing it and working it. But I found for me, journaling and meditation, along with rewiring my brain, is how I have healed myself.
Yeah. That's great. How long ago did you, I guess, like participate in doing Nicole's program or really going down this path? And then I also want to follow up to, you know, in your 20s, you read the Sarno book, and here we are all these years later. Did that thought, you know, come to mind? But let's come back to that question. How long ago did you start journaling and doing Nicole's program and doing all that kind of stuff?
I attended the program in September. The retreat in September.
Five-ish or so months ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which I'm assuming was virtual at that point, right?
Yes. Okay. Everything has been virtual.
Okay.
Everything has been virtual.
Terrific. So you go to the retreat, you start doing the program. I guess, like, what sort of things did you maybe learn about yourself that you, because you had said the forgiveness of the surgeries and such, but I'm just sort of curious on what sort of underlying themes were you pulling up in that?
Great question.
In that realm, yeah.
So much of my personality needing to, I want to say, being a goodist was huge for me. Being a people pleaser to a fault was huge for me. And through journaling and Sarno's theory and method, I have found that uncovering my truth, where I can rage on, you know, the page, you know, and with absolute freedom to say whatever I'm feeling,
yeah,
has uncovered so much of a process of self-discovery in who I always thought I had to be, because of traumas that I endured from a young age, yep, to a life with curiosity. And so I have really, truly learned to replace fear with curiosity. And I feel that that is huge in recovering from TMS. Recovering from chronic pain. Yeah.
I'm writing down that replacing fear with curiosity. I mean, I think that's great. What sort of, you know, you're like months removed from doing that stuff now. Is there like a regular practice that you do or a routine or anything like that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So my regular practice, I journal every day, and some days I'll miss it, but that perfectionist in me before would be like, oh, you're not being a good student.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm a straight A student to a fault. Right. But that I understand was me needing to be safe with what I could control growing up, you know, being good, being a good student and all that. So even if I've kind of, if there was a day that went by, it's more of like, oh, what's the resistance I have to journaling that day? Or, okay, I'll get back to it tomorrow.
Do you have,
so journaling has been huge.
Do you have any commentary on one thing that I often think about people that are, that have been athletic in their past? I mean, Pilates is like, it's no bullshit. Even though like I'm a weightlifter, still can have a great appreciation for anybody that does gymnastics, anybody that does Pilates, anybody that does any of that kind of stuff, that your body has to be strong. As you look back now and you're thinking you had all these health issues and hurts and pain issues and all that kind of stuff. Yet, I mean, you definitely were strong at one point in time. How do you like think back on that? Or is there any commentary you can provide? Because to me, I'm a lot of me is like the logic of pain, particularly in athletes, chronic pain in athletes is really pretty stupid because for me, like, you know, right before all this pain stuff started, you know, I was squatting 300 or 325 pounds and I was able to clean 260 pounds and I could, you know, do all these things. But then why did it hurt so bad to do anything, pick up anything? Didn't even matter what, just a regular everyday thing, you know, a 35 pound anything. And years, and it's tough when you're in the midst of the forest because you can't really, you don't really have that perspective. But now I can look back and say that really made no sense. Do you have any commentary on that in your case?
Absolutely. Because it really makes zero sense. Mm-hmm. And again, my answer to that is fear, because I was that girl from a young age that was, I remember I was a sprinter and I played softball and I played basketball and I played soccer and I ran in college, you know, just like on my own, obviously, but like that was always my release.
Right.
And to think that a little thing like bending over and standing up the wrong way, you know, could cause this horrible, like, physical injury, it just makes zero sense. But to me, it shows how suggestible we are as humans with the information that we're given.
Yep.
Because it doesn't make any sense. And I've always been super strong and I've always valued myself and I'm super tough. I'm super strong. I was always that girl in the Pilates classes that would be the last one to get down from a plank. Right? Like I had to be best always. When I was in Barry's boot camp classes, pushing myself to the limit, whatever class it was, I was so competitive and it's in my nature to be competitive. So when you think about that athlete that you can relate to with me, it's, I can bring it on. I can take it. Right. And to think that something so small could put you in like complete, I want to say laid up on the bed and you can't move, right? Is just connected again to not trusting yourself.
It's a different world right now in the midst of the pandemic, but let's say that you are in class now. I mean, do you still have that competitive fire with other people, or is that sort of dwindled away, or what's, I guess, you know, what is Jacqueline like now in that regard?
It's a great question, because the silver lining of the pandemic, I was, if I could start off answering it in this way, I was at UCLA. I came back from my surgery. I came back to UCLA in December. I was there for a few months. The pandemic hit.
Yeah.
So there I am, home with two small children, working with all patients, telehealth, virtually. And I, before the pandemic started, got a Pilates machine. And one of my old Pilates instructors started doing virtual classes, which was so think of like the Peloton version for Pilates. Yep. So I was really lucky. And I said, there is no way that I am not going to do Pilates again.
Yeah.
I am not going to confine myself to walking.
Yep.
That's bullshit for me. No way. But I had to get the courage over time to trust that I was okay. And I think that that's a huge part of TMS, is trusting that you are okay and that you can do whatever you want, mm-hmm. as long as you are your friend and not your enemy, yeah. if that makes sense.
Yep.
So I'm doing Pilates like I used to. I wouldn't say with the same intensity of it needing to be, I'm going to hold this plank for 2 minutes and I'm, you know, I'm not good enough if I'm not. It's a shift in mindset in how I approach myself with exercise now. But I'm doing Pilates and I'm jogging and I'm doing, you know, I'm exercising.
One interesting perspective that I feel like I have gained out of this when it relates to athletics is because I had shut it down for probably 6 months of not really doing anything and just resorting to walking, as you're you're talking about. And then when I read the Sarno stuff and it kind of totally flipped it, you know, flipped the whole idea on its head, and I wasn't pain free by any means, but did just step right back into the fire of doing. I mean, I couldn't even put my arms over my head really for several months without a lot of fear. And then just started doing snatches and clean and jerks literally a couple days later after reading the book. And one of the things that's always struck me is that I know that like there's coaches that are like CrossFit coaches and weightlifting coaches, like they're there for a reason. Part of it's motivation. That's a big key of what it is that they do. But when I would be in classes and such, and they would, you know, say that you know, do this rep, go, all that kind of stuff. We're usually like, you know, 10 years ago, that probably would have really pumped me up. But me usually in that second, I kind of get this like, I get a bunch of thoughts swirling in my head where I'm like, I got all this stuff going on. I got this work thing. I got this stuff I'm stressing about, all this kind of stuff. So I have no necessity to have to push it that far because I'm good with whatever it is that happens. So I feel you. It sounds like we're very much aligned in that regard.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But I think the biggest piece for me in this is shifting my relationship with myself, that it was always a sense of me being, I want to say disconnected from my body, that in terms of like if you think of an eating disorder piece or a body image piece, it has to be this way and I need to maintain this. And it's shifted into a sense of appreciation of my body and what it's able to do. So that's a very, very big shift for me.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. So you're speaking of shifting, talk about your shift in your profession now. Because just the ferocity to which your tone was when we talked a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
Talk about more specifically what you were doing as a profession 6 months ago or 8 months ago or whatever. And then what is that turning into now? And what does the next year or so look like?
Awesome. So I specialized in borderline personality disorder at UCLA,
okay.
which means that I worked with students that had a ton of significant trauma. And it wasn't just borderline personality issues, but what I say that is I really worked on helping people regulate their emotions that came from really insecure attachments, whether there was anxiety-ridden attachments, insecure, ambivalent attachment, and how it shaped young adults and shapes adults later in life in terms of being able to establish healthy relationships interpersonally and romantically.
Yeah.
I worked with a ton of trauma, specialized in eating disorder work. And also, I want to say just severe, significant, as you can imagine, anxiety and depression has gone skyrocketed, with the advent of just different social media
yep.
as well for young ones. So I did that for 7 years. And again, the silver lining of this pandemic for me is that I found this work and I realized, holy shit, I'm not broken. I'm okay. And I had to do a whole lot of soul searching into my career. And I always said that I don't know if I'll ever leave UCLA because it was invaluable. My time there, the amount of, that I learned, my colleagues, my time there was just incredible. But I said, this is my passion, helping people recover through chronic pain. This is what I'm meant to do.
Yeah.
And I get it because I lived it and I breathed it. And I understand it on such a deep level that I am going to take this next step in my life, which was I left UCLA in January and I fully transitioned into my private practice.
Awesome.
I started my private practice back in October, but I fully transitioned into my practice in January. So I am so excited because I've learned that the pain is the littlest part into this work. And so much in this work to me through my personal journey and helping others is helping people find their truth, which means what are you not allowing yourself to feel? What are you afraid to feel? And how much it makes sense that our brain and central nervous system seek pain as far less a threat than our repressed emotions.
Yeah.
And really helping from a psychoeducational standpoint, as well as but also helping people understand that they're okay. And this work, I feel it is so important for people to hear that you are okay, that everything that you've been told, and a lot of times people get to this work out of sheer desperation as I did. And so sometimes you're finally at this place because you have nothing to lose at this point. So I have chronic pain patients in my practice, and I find a lot in terms of, it's so hard, the resistance piece of letting go of what medical doctors are telling you or letting go of the structural ideas in your mind. And I tell patients, and, you know, I think of different cases, but in terms of what do you have to lose?
Yep.
Right? What do you have to lose? And through developing a sense of connection to me and willingness to be open-minded and develop that real important piece of curiosity is such a huge first step.
Yeah, absolutely. What, as we kind of wrap up here, what do you think is, and if there's not a particular one, that's totally okay, but, is there like a particular, I guess, thing that maybe like a uniqueness that you feel like your methodology or you, the way that you work with clients is maybe like what is the thing that makes Jacqueline's approach or story relatable for certain people? Like as an example, the if I were to be a therapist in my dream world, my focus, I would like it to be, let me put it this way. A few years ago when I had first started doing like remote athletic coaching, the marketer who was writing some of the advertising with me had asked, who is your target customer? I said, it's me. Like it's a guy in the, you know, early to mid 30s, maybe had a significant health issue, wasn't in their sport and then returned to their sport. Like that's kind of the ideal customer for me. Is there an ideal person that you know, what's a particular demographic, or is there a gender, or is there a background, or is there anything that you feel like maybe is more specialized to you? Or is it just a little bit more general because this condition is really the human condition?
Great question. And I will say, because of my valuable time at UCLA, I worked with people suffering with such trauma, LGBTQ issues. I worked with just such an extensive demographic range, right? That gave me such tools in my toolbox to understand that you also have to take into account people's cultural understanding and perspective on therapy in general.
Yep.
And what it means even in one's family or cultural piece to be able to talk about feelings in general, right? And it's been so stigmatized for so long just as it is. And now things are moving, like especially with the pandemic. People are searching for therapy, and it's beautiful because we all can benefit from therapy at any point of our lives, because it's really about developing a better understanding of yourself and how you operate in the world around you. So when you ask me about a key client, I have to truly say that I've worked with it all, but the pain piece for me has allowed me to integrate the mind body as a whole to get to the root of one's suffering.
Awesome. Maybe one thing that I think would be really cool, because you know, the therapists that I've interviewed on here, they've been doing this discipline for years. With you being more beginning in the chronic pain treatment of it, I'd be really curious for us to maybe do like a part two, maybe towards the end of the summer, after there's like 6 months of, and I imagine by the end of the summer, the United States, at least, will look like a very different place when it comes to the pandemic, which is great.
Yes.
I feel like it's turning a good corner. And when I'm looking at the data and the 15 death rate's still a little bit higher than, but that's a lagging indicator. And the other, you know, the positivity rates are dropping. And as a matter of fact, spoiler fourth wall alert, we are recording this about a month before it's going to air. So we're recording this in mid-February and it's airing mid-March.
Right.
So who knows? Maybe by the time you listen to this, it's even further different in a better way. Okay, so as we close, where can people listen to this to find where can people find out more about you? They're sitting there and they're like, man, Jacqueline, like it's really resonating with me. I want to see more of what she's about. Where do people find that?
Yes, people can find me at JacquelineNatesMFT.com. And I will have my specialized, you know, TMS approach. And I'm also working on being able to do coaching completely separate from psychotherapy, because there's such a vast need for people all over the world. And to be able to give people tools in their toolbox to work with that's very specific to a program where they can go off and do it on their own.
Yep. Awesome. Jacqueline, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we'll hear from you again sometime in either August or September. But thank you so much for your time.
I so appreciate it. And thank you so much for doing this work and spreading this message.